Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Real Talks. My name is David Steele. Happy to be back. Had to take about a week off because I am trying to get together some stuff for the show in general. So I am getting the podcast back up and running. So what I've been doing for the past 3 or 4 days is I have been going through all of the old shows, and there are about, I think, 7 or 8 of them on there, and I'll be adding them, you know, on a consistent basis. I'm going to be putting all of the old shows, so if you guys can't or don't want to watch YouTube or can't get there, you guys can go to your favorite podcast, you know, hosting place, whether it's iHeartRadio or Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and I will eventually put all the stuff on SoundCloud. And you guys can listen to them. So eventually, when I get all caught up, you guys will be getting the daily show in audio form. So that way, if you're at work or you're in the gym or you're out for a jog, you can just, you know, pop it on and you'll have the show. So that was one thing that happened. The other thing, too, is my phone completely went haywire. So I was at the Apple store all weekend, basically trying to figure out what was wrong. I went back like 3 times, ended up getting a new phone. So now I have to download all of the apps that I used to have in my old phone on my new phone. Luckily, all the pictures were saved, all the videos were saved, so that's good news. Anyways, we had a lot of stuff go on in the last 72 hours. And something I want to talk about, maybe it will be a different video because I don't want this to go on too long, is what happened on Friday. So as everybody knows, maybe you don't know because you haven't looked at the rap. So one of the writers actually dropped a huge, huge spoiler for, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. So I don't want to spoil for anybody that's going to watch this, dropped a huge spoiler for the upcoming movie Fast 10. And I have a lot of thoughts on why it happened now and when it happened and everything else. But I think I'm going to do a whole video for that because there is so much to go through. Anyways, let's jump right into today's show. Speaking of a lot of things to get to, we have 5 or 6 big stories to get to. So I figure we would just jump right into all that stuff. So the first story of the day, and kind of shocking to me, not shocking, is Guardians of the Galaxy. So everybody knew, it was, and I said this before, okay, this was going to win 2 weekends. Okay, it was going to win the 5th, and it was going to win the 12th. And I was right. But when I saw the amount of money it made over the weekend, I was really kind of taken. I wouldn't say taken aback by it, but surprised. And in a good way, in a very, very good way. Because it's one of those things where this just made a lot of money. But yeah, so it made a lot of money, and it's refreshing to see. It's refreshing to see. And when I always talk about box office and everything else, this is what a box office roughly should do for certain films. And so we're going to get to the article right now. So this comes to us from the Hollywood Reporter. So James Gunn's Band of Galactic Rascals are proving their worth to box office, as Guardians of the Galaxy enjoyed the second best weekend hold of any sequel in the MCU and the second best among any MCU title, according to final weekend numbers. From Marvel Studios and Disney, the threequel grossed an estimated $62.6 million from 4,450 theaters in its sophomore outing, a mere 47% decline and more than enough to crush the competition. That's up Sundays from $60.5 million estimate. In more good news, the pit crossed the $200 million mark domestically to finish Sunday with a cumulative total of $215.6 million. Overall, Guardians 3 took in another $91 million from 52 markets for a foreign tally of $315.6 million, including a pleasing $58.4 million from China and $530.9 million globally. Marvel movies have suffered larger than usual drops as of late, So Guardians 3 is welcome news for Kevin Feige's Marvel Studios. That includes February's Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, which fell off nearly 70% in its second weekend. In only two weekends, Guardians has rocketed past Quantumania's entire global total of $475.8 million. Before Guardians 3, only five films in the 30-plus MCU films or universe had fallen by 50% or less in their second weekends. The list is topped by Black Panther, which fell 45%, followed by the original Thor at 47%, Doctor Strange at 49%, Iron Man at 50%, and Avengers at 50%. The previous two Guardians movies each declined 55%. Holding at number two was Universal and Illumination's The Super Mario Brothers movie, which grossed $12.6 million from 3,800 theaters in its sixth weekend for a domestic tally of $535 million, went in $1.21 billion globally, according to final weekend numbers. This week, Super Mario shattered another record when overtaking Minions to become the fourth biggest animated film of all time and the biggest Universal animated title, not adjusted for inflation. New offering Book Club, The Next Chapter, only managed a third place finish with a disappointing $6.5 million from 3,500 theaters domestic, well behind the $13.6 million from the first Book Club in 2018. From Focus Films, the film star-studded cast also was an ensemble, Candice Bergen, Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, and Mary Steenburgen. Book Club 2 is hoping to see a big bump thanks to Mother's Day. But complicating factors, including was a so-so cinema score from audiences, the first picture earned an A-, and unfavorable reviews. Also, in the age of streaming, older females remained a difficult demographic to win over. Among Friday's ticket buyers for Book Club 2, 73% were female, while 67% were age 45 or older, and nearly 50% were over 55. Holdover Evil Dead Rise continued to scare up good business for Warner Brothers, placing fourth domestically with $3.7 million for a domestic tally of $60.2 million. It earned another $6.7 million overseas for a cumulative total of $71.6 million and $131.8 million globally. Lionsgate, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, rounded out the top five with $2.5 million for a somewhat subdued $16.5 million. The news is notably worse for the weekend's other big player, Hypnotic, directed by Robert Rodriguez and starring Ben Affleck. The sci-fi thriller bombed at $2.4 million from 2,100 theaters, was good for a sixth place finish. The movie marks the worst worldwide opening for Affleck's acting career behind Phantoms and Chile, not adjusted for inflation. It's also the lowest wide opening for a film directed by Rodriguez. Far more important, though, Affleck in his previous movie, Air, which he directed and stars in, the acclaimed sports drama, comes to Prime Video this weekend after receiving an exclusive run in theaters in an unprecedented move for Amazon Studios. Air has earned north of $86 million in a promising start for Amazon's foray into theatrical. So let's talk about this. This is fantastic news all the way around. Yeah, so Coco says Mario got to $1.2 billion. It just keeps making money in second place at $12.6 billion or million dollars. But this is just the unbelievable run this movie has had. And it's fascinating. And so I'm going to bring it up, and I'm not going to tell you what the spoiler is. But there was a big to-do about, there was a journalist at the Wrap, and I have seen Guardians, Coco. I've seen Guardians. As a matter of fact, if you want to go back, I have seen Guardians. If you want to go back and watch the spoiler cast I did with Matthew Anderson, we did a whole spoiler cast on, so he says that you thought Mario would plummet. I knew he was going to, I really did. I thought Mario was not going to do well. Shows you what I know. So that being said, Guardians is just, this is an amazing film. Just for the, not only the simple success of what it's done, but how well it held. And I think that's the important thing here. And Marvel really needed the win because, of course, the Ant-Man dropped off like a cliff at 70%. But I come out and said, okay, at the beginning of the day, okay, I came out and said that Guardians was going to win 2 weeks. And it did. It won the 5th and it won the 12th. Now we have Fast 10 coming out this weekend. And so the big thing about that is that one of the writers for one of the trades actually dropped a big spoiler. And yeah, so the post-credit scene was good, Coco. I agree with you. And it brings up an interesting point that I'll get to in a minute, is now Marvel has all these sequels that they're trying to juggle, right? So they've got Black Panther Wakanda Forever. They've got Guardians. It'll be interesting to see, you know, where they go and how they do it. They said, oh, Fast 10. You're talking about Fast 10. Yeah. So, I mean, so that being said, I'm not going to say what the spoiler was, okay? But what I will say is this. It brings up a whole conversation of spoilers in general and why they did it when they did it. But nonetheless, this is good. This is great news for Guardians. And I really hope that this continues to do well. I have no doubt in my mind it will. So that being said, it should make $25 to $35 million next week. I'm really happy for it. James Gunn and what he's done with this, and it was fantastic. I can't wait to I want to see it again. I do. The fact that Mario made almost $13 million. Can we just talk about that for a minute? I mean, we all knew this was going to win. But almost $13 million? Now, you're right, Coco. I was saying it wasn't going to do well. You're absolutely right. And it just keeps making money and money. And they can't print enough money for this. Anyways, I think that it's going to be fantastic. We actually have another story coming a little later on in the show about a film that's going to be making its release on streaming. So stay tuned for that in a couple of minutes. But yeah, so, I mean, it's one of those things where I think that this is definitely a success, obviously. But moreover than that, I think that I can't wait. If it's this good here, I can't wait to see what it does on Disney Plus. So, I mean, you're talking about maybe by the end of the summer, maybe September, October. You're talking about this maybe on Disney Plus. So this is a spoiler. I wouldn't necessarily say a spoiler. By the way, at the end, when Groot says, I love you guys, he's not actually speaking. It's, we've just been with the Guardians for so long, we understand him. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. James Gunn did a phenomenal job with this movie. He did a phenomenal job with it. And this is why his movies do so well. This is why his movies do so well. Because they're emotion. He hits on all of the nerves that you want. It's emotional. It's funny. I mean, I would say this, Coco, okay? And I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this. Go back and, yeah, I'm sure, I have no doubt. Go back. So he says James Gunn explained it, by the way. He's right. So what he did, he was actually did a story on this a while back. He said the first one was about the father, the mother. The second one was about the father. And the third one was about themselves. I'd be curious. Go back, Coco, actually watch the spoiler cast. I want to see if you actually, what your thoughts about it were, because I think that that's an interesting thing. But this movie is just fantastic. And it's really what Marvel needed right now. It's really what they needed. I think if we had the Marvels come out in July, I think it would have been too soon. So I'm really, really happy this has actually moved to November. The legendary Star-Lord gave me goosebumps. Yeah. It's a good send-off movie. It really is. So, I mean, yeah, it's a fantastic movie. I'm going to go see it again probably, you know, at some point, because it deserves a second viewing. It really does. But anyways, guys, what do you think about this? How many times have you seen Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3? Did you like the soundtrack? What was the best part for you? Let me your thoughts down in the comments and I'll get back to everybody. Okay, so before we move on real quick, unlike the Love and Thunder, this balances the humor and seriousness in Guardians. Yeah, and that's why James Gunn is so good at what he does. And that, and I keep saying it, I cannot wait for Superman Legacy. We've got a story about that coming up a little later, but I can't wait for that. And if it's anything like that, look out. So moving on, going from theatrical, we go to a major, major film festival that's happening right now in Cannes, in France right now. And there's an interesting little thing going on. So a couple months ago, I did a story about Killers of the Flower Moon actually premiering at Cannes. And they have two different subsets. They have in competition and they have out of competition. Now, if you're in competition, you actually get a chance to win what's called the Palme d'Or, or Best Director, or Best Film. So actually, what's going to end up happening is, so the caveat for it, okay, is that if you do enter it in competition, the streaming rights, it has to be in certain things, and I'll get to it in the article, but Scorsese is not, and Apple are not going to actually put it in competition. So it's fascinating. So this comes from THR, and it's talking about how it's not going to be put in. At the 2023 Cannes Film Festival, which kicks off Tuesday, six titles, not counting midnight showings or the TV series The Idol, will screen, quote, out of competition, end quote, meaning a big red carpet premiere and the heavy media coverage that accompanies one, but without eligibility for festival prizes. The festival includes John DeBerry, starring Johnny Depp, okay, following in the footsteps of star vehicles when ranging from 2011 The Beaver to the 2018 Gotti. Feature of festival closer, Elemental, from Pixar. That's the new one coming out in June. Animated Pixar, never invited into competition. Franchise flick Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, okay. And Kill Bill, The Matrix, Ocean, Star Wars, and X-Men have also done this. And most highly anticipated title, Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. Among these, Killers is a unique case in the festival's director, in that the festival director, Thiat Vermeon, revealed in April that it was and remains invited to screen in competition. He said that it initially offered the film only an out-of-competition slot, since its worldwide digital distributor, Apple, like most other streamers, won't usually wait for a long theatrical window prior to streaming, as required by the festival for a competition slot. But then Apple indicated it would do it, so it Killers, which was going to be theatrically distributed by Paramount in France and the United States. So, and he's explained, quote, well, in that case, you are welcome in competition, and we'll see how the response is, end quote. Scorsese, who had previously done a number of films at Cannes, both in competition and had won for including Taxi Driver, which won the Palme d'Or in 1976, and later in 1985 for After Hours, in out of competition for several documentaries, and Apple have opted not to take up his offer. That begs the question, why would a legendary filmmaker and a flesh distributor armed with what he describes as, quote, an extremely long film, end quote, that drove him to tears and not want to screen in competition at the world's most prestigious film festival? Some filmmakers are adverse to the idea of competition. Woody Allen, for example, had brought more than a dozen films to Cannes, dating all the way back to 1979's Manhattan. Three opened the festival, but none have played in competition. Allen explained in 2016, for any group to judge other people is one thing, one should never do. I don't believe in it, and I don't want to participate. Others followed suit. So this is basically, there is another director that says, I don't want to be in competition anywhere. And that was the takeaway of Stephen Franz after he presided over the competition jury in 2007, despite having previously won multiple films in competition. He kept his next title, 2010's Tomorrow Drive, out of it. So older titles of a filmmaker and or distributor is concerning managing for expectations. The New York Times noted all the way back in 1974, an increasing number of established filmmakers declined to compete at Cannes, reasoning the loss of the grand prize to some upstart newcomer can be more damaging than winning than can be prestigious. Columbia Film University's professor Anat Andres Vall, a veteran of the many Cannes festivals, tells THR, "I don't ever recall it helping the masters, quote, masters who have filmed the competition. There is less pressure for filmmakers when there is work and reviewed. That factored in the calculation of keeping Ann Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon out of competition in 1999. So it goes on and it talks about many different filmmakers. And basically, that said, nobody knows how Scorsese, basically it's this, guys. Is this going to, oh, thank you. Thank you, Metal. So basically it's talking about this. Okay, we have a film here that's not going to take the in competition for several reasons or another. One of them is the fact of if it is streamed in competition, you're talking about 18 months before it can be put on stream. That means if this is a $250 million production, which all of the things might, you know, even $200 million, you're not going to be getting anything recouped. This is going to be, I believe they've already got a date set here in the States. They want this to make as much money as they can, because here's the thing too. This is a award season darling, okay? So it's one of those things where, I mean, you've got arguably his two muses, okay? I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio there on the left and Robert De Niro there on the right. And this is about a murder mystery and everything else. It looks, everything about this looks very, very good. And so, of course, this is based off the book by David Gran. Okay, which I actually have sitting at my bedside table right now, because I will be reading Killers of the Flower Moon before this gets released, because I'm dying to see this just like everybody else. And I think that this is going to do well. But even if, let's face it, even if this doesn't do well monetarily, box office wise, this is going to get a lot of play at the award season. Mark my words, whether it's, you know, the Golden Globes or the Oscars, this is going to all about the award season. So, I mean, all you got to do is look at The Irishman, right? The Irishman was 3.5 hours. And look how many nominations that got. Now, did it win a lot of them? No. But it's just a simple premise of you had everybody coming together. Once again, you've got Leonardo DiCaprio. You've got Robert De Niro. You've got Brendan Fraser. You've got Lily Gladstone. You've got a bunch of people in this. I can't wait. And the fact that it's been really kept under wraps, it's fascinating that we're talking about a film that nobody knows anything about. And, you know, unless you've read the book, which I will start doing momentarily, nobody knows anything about. So it's going to be interesting to see what Apple does and Scorsese does. I think that they're going to, it's not about money for Scorsese. It's not about arrogance. It's not about money. It's not anything like that. It's, I just want this on as many eyeballs as possible. Anyways, guys, what do you guys think about this news about Scorsese not screening this in competition at Cannes? Do you think this is a loss for him, even though he's won before? Do you think this is a good thing because they're going to be able to make more money from this? Let me know your thoughts down in the comments and I'll get back to everybody. Okay, so we go from one serious movie to another. And this serious movie is going to be coming out in, I don't know, about a month or so. And I'm talking about Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer looks awesome. There's no other way to say it. Oppenheimer looks amazing. Anybody that's seen the trailer or trailers that are out, this is just Christopher Nolan. And nothing is ever going to get to The Dark Knight. I think that's his masterclass, personally speaking. You know, I mean, Inception was very good. Memento was very good. You know, Dunkirk was awesome. But I think this, The Dark Knight, was amazing. It's a masterclass, in my opinion. But this is going to be, when we're done talking about Nolan, I think we're done. This is going to be in his top five films. I really, truly, honestly believe that. And so this comes to us from Variety. And it says, Christopher Nolan cast a lot of, quote, a lot of real scientists, end quote, as Oppenheimer extras. We have to be faithful to history, he says. Christopher Nolan revealed to EW that he cast a lot of real scientists as extras in Oppenheimer, historical drama about theoretical physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, the Manhattan Project, and the creation of the atomic bomb. The cast is full of stars, such as Cillian Murphy, pictured there, Emily Blunt, Robert Downey Jr., Matt Damon, and Florence Pugh. So Blunt plays his wife, but no one made it sure to bring in actual scientists for certain scenes to maintain the film's authenticity. We were in the real Los Alamitos when we had all these real scientists as extras, Nolan said. We needed the crowd of extras to give reactions and improvise, and we were getting sort of impromptu, very educated speeches. It was really fun to listen to. Nolan continued, "You've been on sets where you get a lot of extras around, and they're more or less thinking about lunch. These guys were thinking about how the geopolitical implications of nuclear arms, and they knew a lot about it. It was actually a great reminder every day of we have to be really on our game, and we have to be faithful to the history here and really know what we're up against." Murphy added to Entertainment Weekly about the cast, "Every day you had these phenomenal actors who are heroes of mine coming in. Every day you were having to raise your game to work with these legends. Everybody was so unbelievably well prepared. Every single actor, no matter what size their role or significance their character in history, each of them had the massive depth of knowledge that they could draw on." While no one brought in real scientists to start, Murphy did not concern himself too much with the science behind the atomic bomb when prepping to play Oppenheimer. Instead, he read everything he could about the man himself. "I prepped by doing an awful lot of reading," Murphy told The Guardian last year. "I'm interested in the man and what it does to the individual. The mechanics, that's not really for me. I don't have the intellectual capacity to understand them. But these contradictory characters are fascinating." In his commitment to authenticity, Nolan also found a way to recreate atomic bomb explosions without using CGI. The filmmaker has always favored practical effects over visual effects. He even blew up a real plane for a Boeing 747 for Tenet. "I think recreating the Trinity test, the first nuclear war weapon detonation in New Mexico, without the use of computer graphics was a huge challenge to take on," Nolan told Total Film Magazine earlier this year. "Andrew Jackson, my visual effects supervisor, I got him on board early on and was looking how we could do a lot of the visual elements of the film practically, from representing quantum dynamics and representing quantum physics to the Trinity test itself, to recreating with my team Los Alamos up in a mesa in New Mexico in extraordinary weather, which a lot of which was needed for the film in terms of the very harsh conditions out there. There were huge practical challenges." Oppenheimer is set to open in theaters nationwide July 21st from Universal Studios. Okay, let's talk about this because this is huge. The fact that they did this practically. Florence Pugh might play his first wife or the lady he has as a side chick. Yeah, so I don't know exactly. I think she might be one of the scientists or the lady who left her husband. I'm not sure. As a matter of fact, you know what? I don't know. I'm going to actually bring her name up, and I will tell you what her role is. And then, I don't know exactly what, I could be wrong. So Florence Pugh is Jean Tatlock. That is her role. That is the name of her character. I don't know if she's a scientist, so you can Google her if you want, but she is the lead. She is the lead there. So she's actually higher in the grand scheme of things. She's higher than Murphy. But nonetheless, I think she might be a scientist. But this looks outstanding. I think that when you talk about practical elements and how they're done, this is one of the biggest challenges. So we just saw Top Gun Maverick this last year. I had the privilege of going to a Q&A and watching Top Gun Maverick and going to a Q&A with Joseph Kaczynski. And, you know, he talked about how Tom Cruise wanted to hold it because he knew it was going to be a moneymaker, and it was. But one of the biggest things that he did was that it was all practical effects. And the fact is, when you're doing practical effects, it's a lot, because anybody can do CGI, but it's what can you do with that and how you do it. That being said, I think that if this is done practically, look out. I can't wait for this. Not just because of the story. I think that's a thing. Because he is one of those unwritten characters in history that nobody knows about. We all know that the atomic bomb was dropped in Japan, but we don't know the story behind it. And that's what makes it so fascinating and interesting. I think that when you're talking about a film and a man that had to deal with all of this, and they did, by the way, they didn't even know this was going to work. They didn't even know if this was going to work. And that's a big thing, too. I mean, you see this picture here with, you know, Matt Damon, who stars in this, is the general, you know, or one of the chief of staff, one of the military guys. I think no one's outdone himself. But getting back to the practical effects, the reason why they use practical effects in Top Gun Maverick is Tom wanted to make it look authentic. And that's what he's wanting to do here. He wants to make it look authentic. And when you do that, people go, oh, wow, that's really cool. So if the acting is as good as the cast is, look out. Because here's the thing. This is Cillian Murphy's fifth film with Christopher Nolan. People forget about that. This is his fifth film with him, right? I mean, everybody remembers him from, like, Batman Begins, right, as Scarecrow. But this is his fifth film. So he knows what he wants. He, you know, I hear they're talking. There's talks of another one. I think spinoffs, probably. This is going to be awesome, and I can't wait to see this. And I think that, look out, you could see some Academy Award nominations for this. I'm telling you right now, there's a chance that you might see some Academy Award nominations for this. But anyways, guys, what do you think about Oppenheimer? What do you think about Christopher Nolan coming out and saying, I did all these effects practically so I could get more authenticity? Do you think he could have and did it right? Or do you think he should have used CGI for this? Let me know your thoughts down in the comments and I'll get back to everybody. Okay, so we're moving on to another story that it's troubling and it's fascinating at the same time. And so bear with me. And I'm talking about Mission Impossible. Now, I've been a champion of this as long as it's been out or is going to be coming out. And I've been a champion because I can't wait to see this movie and everything else. And I think that when you hear stories, it's, you know, a little troubling in how it was done, okay? And the reason I bring this up is because Simon Pegg, of course, he's a fantastic actor and he's been in four or five of these. He told Deadline, quote, he kept his alcoholism secret on Mission Impossible set, reveals, quote, simple friendship with Tom Cruise. Simon Pegg has revealed how he previously hid his alcoholism from his cast and crew on the set of Mission Impossible. The actor who played IMF technical field agent Benji Dunn in the longtime franchise told the BBC's Desert Island Discs radio interview program that he suffered from a mental health episode during the filming of Mission Impossible 3 back in 2006 and turned to alcohol. You become very sneaky when you have something like that in your life. You learn how to do it without anyone noticing because it takes over. It wants to sustain itself and do everything it's willing to do and not to be stopped. But eventually it gets to a point where it can't be hidden. And that's when, thankfully, I was able to pull out of the dive. Pegg, who is now in recovery, also refers to his friendship with co-star Tom Cruise in the interview, admitting he sometimes mocks a superstar from his unique level of fame and privilege it brings. We joke about it. I mean, I always make fun of him, you know, about the things he can access. He kind of appreciates the ridiculousness of it sometimes. My relationship with him is just very simple and amicable, said Pegg. It's always been a very easy relationship. I think when you meet the person rather than the thick of mythology that's built up around it, it's a different experience. I mean, he loves the fame and relishes it, but it's all he knows. It energizes and spurs him on. One subject remains off limits, however, between the pair. Asked if he discussed Cruz's faith in the Church of Scientology, Peg says, believing it would, quote, abuse my privileged access that I get to him, end quote. Okay. This is troubling to a certain number of things. I love these movies. Yeah, absolutely. I do. So as a matter of fact, I'm doing a whole Mission Impossible rewatch. I just did the second one about a week ago or 2 weeks ago. You can find that in the channel. I'll be doing Mission Impossible 3 very shortly. And by the time we get to July 14th, I will have done all the Mission Impossible rewatches. So go check that out if you really do. But I do enjoy that. But you're right. So, I mean, I love these movies. Love, love, love these movies. And you, when you go back and you look at the history of it, right? Because, so in the first Mission Impossible video, I talk about how this whole franchise really started. And in that, because one of the things that was done was, you looked in the mid-90s, right? You had a lot of television remakes come out. You had the Beverly Hillbillies. You had the Flintstones. You had, you know, all of these films, even if they weren't good. And subsequently, Mission Impossible was one of those films when he started his production company with his then agent, Paul Wagner. They got access to the whole vault. And so he went through and said, I want to do Mission Impossible. And when you watch, I've actually sat down and watched one of the older Mission Impossibles, and I talk about it in the first video, and it's fascinating. So this franchise, I've always wondered, what would Tom Cruise be without Mission Impossible? Now, it's interesting because this has been his baby for the past 25 years. Now, Mission Impossible 2, the second or the third one, is when he really started to produce. And that's when things started to really kick up speed. And, I mean, I even talked about in the beginning of the second rewatch, while I did like the film, Cruise is, I believe he's one of those movie stars we're never going to see again. He is the last of a generation. All of that being said, I love the films tremendously. But when I hear about this and somebody coming out and saying, I had to hide my alcoholism because of the stress, because of the troubleness of it, and could function barely. But it's one of those things where I wish he could have actually stopped and told Tom, look, I've got a problem. Now, obviously, truth be told, my mother was an alcoholic. Okay, she's no longer with us, but she was an alcoholic. There's two types of alcoholics. There are those that don't care or don't know, okay? And then there are those that don't care. Those that don't know just go about their lives and they just drink and they drink and they survive. Then you have the other kind that don't care. And they don't care who they hurt and how they do it. And it took me a long time to realize that. Nonetheless, when I hear about that, that he couldn't basically say anything, okay? That if that's what started the whole thing, I wish he could have come out and said something to Tom or somebody else. That, hey, look, you know, because he has the clout. If he had told Tom Cruise, because don't forget, this started all the way back in Mission Impossible 3, okay? So this isn't like this is something that's just coming about in the last year or two, right? That being said, he could have very easily, you know, 2006. So you're talking about somebody that's had a problem with alcohol for the past 17 years. Okay. Now, he said he's in recovery, and that's great to hear. But, you know, and the other key thing there I find is interesting is, you know, he says the last line of his the article, okay, says that, you know, the kids about it and he likes about it. But Peg said that one subject remains off limits, however, between the pair. Asked if he discussed Cruise's faith in the Church of Scientology, Peg said, not believing it would, quote, abuse my privileged access that I get to him. Well, here's the thing. Anybody who believes that they're, you know, going to get, I don't know, they're abusing the privileged access, they don't need to be around. I'm sorry. Because nobody is better than anybody else. Just because he's more famous than Simon shouldn't, you know, as a matter of fact, he should want to help him, right? He should want to do all these things. And I think that, you know, Crew's not talking about Scientology, fine. Your faith is your faith. But don't ever believe that it's going to jeopardize your friendship with somebody. And if it does, you need to walk away, okay? Because at the end of the day, it's just a job. So, I mean, I think Simon Pegg would have still been very, would still be known, and he's done several other roles if it weren't for Mission Impossible. But to believe it might damage your access, privileged access, I'm sorry. That's just wrong on every level, because it's one of those things where, you know, nobody is better than the other. I hope that he continues to stay, you know, clean. And I'm sure that after that, I think he will. I have no doubt in my mind. It's kind of a troubling thing to see, though. And it is what it is. Anyways, what do you think about Simon Pegg's comments? I don't even know what to say. No, but seriously, what do you think about his comments coming out now, all these years later, about him being an alcoholic? Do you think that, you know, Tom Cruise had a duty to stop Simon from hurting himself? Let me know your thoughts down in the comments. Okay, so let's go on to something a little more cheery, shall we? So we have all of these movies that we're talking about, either looking forward to or whatever else. And we have a movie that is going to be released on streaming very, very soon. And it made a whole bunch of money box office. And I'm talking Avatar: The Way of Water. So I can't believe this has been, what, 6 months now since it actually started. But that being said, this is finally going to get released on streaming. And it's awesome. I mean, I went to see it in 3D. Go back and watch the spoiler cast I did with Kyle, you know, when he was on the channel. He's seen it like, I don't know, 6 times. But it's a phenomenal movie. And here is the story. Now, this comes from the Wrap. And it says, Avatar: The Way of Water to make streaming debut on Max and Disney Plus in June. Ready to dive into the ocean of Avatar: The Way of Water? The James Cameron-directed epic, well, currently the third highest movie of all time, will be making its streaming debut on Max and Disney Plus on June 7th. The long-awaited sequel to Cameron's Avatar, which was released back in 2009, hit theaters this past Christmas and almost immediately became a runaway success. The sequel, which once again will star Sam Worthington, Zoe Saldana, Sigourney Weaver, and Stephen Lang, saw our heroes from the first film, now with a family, hiding out in a tribe of Na'vi, devoted to the water of Pandora. And of course, the villains from the first movie, now regenerated, even though they're more into a more lethal Na'vi avatars, catch up with our adorable Sully family, and all hell breaks loose. More than a decade between the original and the sequel, and a running time of over 3 hours, Avatar: The Way of Water was far from a sure thing. But given how good the movie was, and as an eye-popping visual thrill ride, and how emotional it resonates, its themes were about animal rights, sacredness of family, and the importance of protecting our oceans, Avatar: The Way of Water quickly became a box office behemoth. It was later nominated for several Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It took home the Oscar for Best Visual Effects, and it was generally next level effects in the animation. I always kid. I said, if that didn't win visual effects, it needed to be an investigation. Since opening around Christmas, Avatar: The Way of Water played in theaters and has done well. Disney didn't even release the movie for digital download until the end of March, and they still haven't set a physical release date for the movie, which is odd considering it will undoubtedly be reference quality 4K Blu-ray release. Earlier, James Cameron movies like The Abyss and True Lies were never released on Blu-ray, let alone 4K Blu-ray. The original Avatar has never made it to 4K despite an upscale theatrical re-release launching last fall. The reason that Avatar The Way of Water will be arriving on Disney Plus and Max, the rebranded HBO Max, stems from a long-standing agreement between 20th Century Fox, which Disney acquired in 2019, and the Warner Brothers Discovery-owned streamer. This has caused much condensation in the past, with some 20th Century movie titles made by Disney going straight to Hulu, just to work around the need as those titles to be delivered to HBO Max. Other joint HBO Max Disney debuts include Steven Spielberg's West Side Story. Mercifully, the agreement between 20th Century and HBO Max ran through the end of 2022. So Avatar The Way of Water will be the last Disney-owned 20th Century movie to go up on the competitor platform first. The next Avatar sequel is scheduled for Christmas of 2024, and it can't come soon enough. Okay, let's talk about this real quick. This is huge. It's huge, huge, huge. If there hadn't one visual effects, as I said, there needed to be an investigation. This is finally coming to Disney Plus, as it should be. And the other thing too is, it's interesting that it's going to Max, as it's called now. I think that at the end of the day, it's going to be interesting to see which streamer actually has more watch time. Is it going to be Is it going to be Max? Or is it going to be Disney Plus? Because I think that if this is one of those things where Max gets a huge bump, and it will get a huge bump, I think that they're going to try and do something. You know, the agreement's run out. We know that. But it's just, you know, I think that at the end of the day, I'll be curious to see which streamer gets the more view time, because I think I think it's going to be Disney Plus, because more people know Max or HBO Max or whatever it's going to be called, Max, for movies. Not to say this isn't a movie, it absolutely is. Look, third all-time grossing. I think this is going to get a lot more play on there than it will, and I'll be curious to see how long it's on there for, right? Is it only on there for 3 months? Is it on there for 6 months? I think, you know, Disney will keep this on for as long as they can, whereas I think Max will do it for a set period of time, and that's it. So, but this is huge. This is huge. And Cameron just outdid himself. I mean, when I went to see it in 3D, I was blown away. Now, I thought the story was okay. It was a little bit of a rehash, but visually, unbelievable. And look out next year, because when this gets to be, you know, when we're coming up on Christmas of next year, this is going to do a whole bunch of money. So, anyways, what do you guys think about Avatar The Way of Water finally being released on streaming? Is this something you've been looking forward to? Where are you going to watch it? Are you going to watch it on Disney Plus? Are you going to watch it on Max? How many times are you going to watch on streaming? How many times did you see it in the theater? Let me know your comments down in the comments section, and I will get back to everybody. Okay, so the last story of the day, and I'm going to bring some of this stuff up. So basically, we have a movie. See if I can find it. So I'll just talk about this without the, there we go. I'm just going to show you the one picture of it, and that's it. So there's a movie coming out. Speaking of James, we're going to start the episode with James Gunn, and we're going to end the episode with James Gunn. So now that he's done with Marvel, he is going to be co-CEO Disney Studio, or not Disney, DC Studios. And his first film is going to be Superman Legacy. So what we know about this is, and everybody's been fan cast, and he's been on Twitter and he's been very vocal about who he's wanted to see it, or not see it, but play it. Or let me rephrase that. He has been vocal about casting because he was prepping casting and everything else. He didn't necessarily have people he wanted to play it. So now it's actually catching up. So this comes from THR and Searching for Superman, Inside the Quest to Cast DC's New Top Hero. The quest for James Gunn's Superman is up, up, and away. Casting for Superman Legacy, the feature meant to kick off Gunn and Peter Safran's much-vaulted first chapter of DC Studios, is hitting a crucial phase with a short list of names bubbling up for the role of Clark Kent, Lois Lane, and even Lex Luthor. David Coruscant, who recently played the ill-fated projectionist opposite Mia Goth and Pearl, is among the top contenders to play Kent, aka Superman, advancing to the screen test that will likely take place after Memorial Day or in early June, multiple sources tell the THR. Two other contenders may also be in the mix, but their identities remain unknown. Jacob Elordi, the sought-after star who broke out in the resident villain on HBO Max's Euphoria, is another name at the surface for the role of Kent, but sources say he never submitted himself into the ring. British stars Tom Brittany and Andrew Richardson were also in the early mix. As for Lane, the spunky reporter at the Metropolis Daily Planet news organization, contenders have been Elmer Mackey, one of the stars of the Netflix series Sex Education, who will also appear in Warner Brothers' Barbie, Rachel Bronson, the Emmy-winning star of Amazon's acclaimed Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. She actually started out, one of her earlier roles was in House of Cards. Bridgerton's actress Phoebe Dwy and Samara Weaving, last seen in Scream 6. It is unclear who is advancing onto the testing stage. Bronson is said to have delivered a, quote, outstanding, end quote, audition, but at 32 may be in the older range for what Gunn is ultimately hoping to achieve, a look at Metropolis heroines via 20-something characters. Forces caution that some of the aforementioned not-screen testing have merely been in the mix. One source, without providing additional detail, dismissed some of the names as, quote, a chat room list, end quote. Warner says no comment and said, one insider said the filmmakers and studios are, quote, are nowhere near a decision, end quote. One role that seems to have, that has only one person earmarked in the classic villain, Luther, Nicholas Holt, starring currently in vampire comedy thriller Renfield, has been tipped to play the bald-headed evil genius. Holt's name has been swirling around Legacy for several weeks now, with some theorizing he was up for Superman. The actor had a previous call with DC's movie realm when he was the runner-up to play Batman for Matt Reeves for the role of Robert Pattinson. The studio has loved him ever since Fury Road, said one source, referring to 2015 action pick by George Miller. While the roles are being chased by many of the town's up-and-comers, and the trio of classic characters says sources say that the movie will be populated by many of its faces and will seek to introduce DC heroes that are already established in the movie setting. Superman Legacy will be the first feature under the Gunn-Safran regime at DC, making the casting of particular note. The superhero holds a particular place of importance for Gunn, saying, quote, I completely relate to Superman because he's everything I am. He told THR in an April cover story, he's somebody who's an outsider who feels like an alien, but is also the ultimate insider because he's fucking Superman. And that's kind of what I like, what I feel. This is a long article. I'm not going to bore you with the whole thing, but let's just talk about this. I think it's the simple fact of, you know, once again, we have possibles, right? We're all speculating. These are all things that are, you know, maybes and hopefuls. And, you know, I'm glad they have a short list. But let's come back when we actually have roles set. I want to see, to do very, very well. And as I said at the top of the show with Guardians, if this is any indication what he's able to do, it's going to be incredible. I have no doubt in my mind about it. But let's come back when we have more of a role set. Because everybody can have short lists. Everybody can have short lists. And it's one of those things where, you know, I think that if you start casting, not casting, but if you start to say, oh, I want this person or I want that person, you know, the other person, you know, I don't care who they get as long as the actor and actress is good. Because that to me, you know, this is where I go back to the story. If you have the best actor or best actress in the world in a horrible story, and you can only do so much. Whereas you can have the worst act, the worst story, you know, story in the world, and the best actress. So I think that it's interesting that they're actually looking for somebody younger. And don't forget, this is going to put them in a realm of fame, just like Daisy Ridley was. And John Boyega and Oscar Isaac. And that's important too. This is going to blow them up. I think that if they, you know, I don't care who they get. I really don't. Now, it could be a no name. That's fine. And I mean, look, I doubt, and I'd be very curious about this, many people knew who Daisy Ridley was before Star Wars The Force Awakens. There were thousands of girls, of young ladies to try out for that role. But she got it. She's a worldwide name now, right? I think that when you get this kind of role, it obviously makes you, you know, you're world famous. But, you know, I mean, Nicholas Hoult, I loved him in The Menu. Now, truth be told, I haven't watched a lot of his stuff. I hope, part of me hopes he gets this role deep down inside, because I did a story a couple months ago. Anybody can go back and watch the piece. He's, as it made mention, the Batman. He missed out on a huge role on the last couple of Mission Impossibles. You know, The Menu was fabulous. I loved him in The Menu. But I really hope he gets this. So I don't care who they get for the actress, though. I really don't. So it is what it is. Let's just, when they come back and they have better, they have a short list. But when they're about ready to cast, then we'll find out. And you're probably not going to hear anything until, I wouldn't be shocked, in the next month or so. I mean, they said Memorial Day. So look for something around the end of May, maybe even June. So we'll see what happens. Anyways, what do you guys think about this whole short list of casting for Superman? Do you have somebody in mind that you'd like to see play Lois Lane, Superman, and Lex Luthor? Leave me your thoughts down in the comments and I'll get back. Okay, so that's it for today's show. It's a longer show than usual. And so, couple of things. I think I'm going to be hosting a space later on tonight about what happened with the spoilers on Fast 10, because I have a lot of thoughts about it and I want to get them out, and making a video is just, I don't think that's the way to go. Anyways, so beyond that though, if you actually do want to follow me on Twitter though, you can follow me. It is, okay, so I don't have it here, but so I will put it in the chat, and that way, that is the Twitter address, and come follow me there. I'm always on Twitter talking about movies or in spaces or doing spaces or whatever. That being said, so there's a couple of things you can do to support me, guys. Number one is Patreon. I have yet to record this month's Patreon, but I will do that shortly. So there is Mob Mondays, and there is Rewatch Wednesdays. Mob Mondays is $5 a month. You get just that video. Rewatch Wednesdays is $10 a month. You'll get both videos. What I'm going to be doing eventually is putting the audio versions, okay, in a subscription form. That's going to be $7.99 a month. So if you don't want to watch the video, you can always watch the audio. You can listen to the audio. Number two, I'm trying to get a store going as it stands. I have a couple of things I want to put in. And once that is done, you'll be able to go on the page and look at that. And that's another way you can support me. Memberships. I only have the one level of memberships right now. It's $2.99 a month. It's very cheap. I understand money is tight with everybody right now. Yeah. And so I have a couple other things. I have a lot going on. Don't forget, guys, we've got the Mission Impossible rewatch series, as I made mention of. I'll be doing episode 3 probably in the next couple weeks. We've got the flashback, or not the Flashback Fridays. That's another show that I did that I'm actually starting to get, want to get back up and running. The audio podcast is Marvel movies. That's a whole other thing. But yeah, so that's all I have today. So stay tuned, guys. And we got spoiler cast coming up. We got the perfect movies coming up. June will be The Dark Knight. So stay tuned for that. Bunch of stuff. So anybody that's popped in here or has been in here before, take a couple minutes, hit that like, hit that subscribe button. It does wonders for me and YouTube and everything else. It gets everything out there. Yeah. So I will be trying to get these podcasts out, you know, in a relatively quick form, mostly weekends, because that's when I'm not, you know, doing the show Monday through Friday. So, okay, guys. So do the three things you need to do. Be safe, be careful, and have a great rest of the day. I'm David Steele. And you have been watching Real Talks. Bye-bye, guys.